Hi, everybody. My name is Joseph Scott, and I am an arrested alcoholic. I'm a year late, and it's all your fault. Because you told me that I was to be honest, I was to be responsible, and I was to be dependable. And because, through your help in the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, my employer, who was trying to fire me 4 years ago, decided last year to give me a couple of $1,000 and send me out to Ogden, Utah. And because of that, I was not here. But I'm here tonight. And I got to talk to my sponsor. I should have buttonholed Leon or Roscoe, because I don't know if righteous indignation is a character defect. And I feel sort of righteously indignant that Calvin would have me come after Van, because I was a dynamic lead. But I want to express my gratitude to the committee and to Calvin for having me here. Also, I did not know what I was to do until I walked through the door last night and got the registration package and saw that I was to deal with the subject on AA in prison. And I'm sort of like the chairperson. Maybe it's because I took a sip. I don't know. But I'm going to deal with it a little bit differently. And I believe in the words of prayer. I prayed before I came here. I asked my higher power to take over and speak to us. And I don't know exactly how what I'm going to say is going to come out. But I'm not going to deal with it in the sense maybe that you're thinking of. To give you just a little bit of background, actually, Van told most of my story. Because I was born and raised in New York City. I was born in the year of 1925, but I was right in the height of Prohibition, and I was raised up during Depression. I remember LaGuardia when he took over as mayor. I also remember some other things that, as a youngster, I felt as a misfit, square peg in a round hole. I'm not going to deal with all of that because, like the big book says, all of my instincts had gone awry. And I began to qualify for this program before I got wet with the character defect, the grandiosity, intellectualism, a lot of prejudice, a lot of resentment, a lot of hatred. In 1937, at the age of 12, I sentenced myself to life in prison with death penalty specification, because it was in 1937 that I took my first drink of wine, had my first drunk, went into my first blackout, and I was on my way. About 2 years later, as a result of some things that was happening in my life, I repeated the incident at 12, did exactly the same thing, drank exactly the same wine, with exactly the same results, with one exception. My father, who had been rather brutal towards me, and whippings that he administered with a leather belt to the extent that he broke the belt on me, when he came to whip me this particular night, my wine told me that I was a man, that I had taken my last beating. And I proceeded to fight him back. And I was a pretty healthy young man. I was pretty athletic. And I punched him and punched him, broke his jaw, messed his nose up, and I left home. And I hit the streets of New York, 14. Some of the places that Van was talking about, I know about them. I attended bar in some of those places. I had made friends with street people, night people, hustlers. Being a people pleaser, I easily fell into the mold. I learned how to gamble. I was a peddler of flesh. Andra. I got involved in drugs, narcotics, became addicted to heroin, used cocaine, was a people pleaser, lived very good, lived very high on the hog, went through the service, came back, joined the 5220 club that he talked about, went to a professional school down on the Bowery, and I used to look at you and shake my head. You aren't any strangers to me because I remembered you from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, when you ate out of garbage cans, when you copulated in the alley women, men, disgusting, disgraceful. And at that those tender years in Brooklyn, I didn't quite understand, but I did associate what was happening with whiskey. When I came back from the service, and I was drinking in the Bowery, and I saw you there, sleeping in doorways and in gutters. Like Van said, if I ever got that bad, which I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. In fact, I never even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never heard of Bill Wilson. But I associated the degradation with drinking. And it was my opinion at that point, if you could not handle your liquor, you should not drink it. I spent more time in the bars on the Bowery than I did in school, but nevertheless, I progressed. When I finished with the schooling, I reverted back to the streets, got some girls and put them on the street, had them turning tricks for me. I'm not very proud of that. I was a gambler. I won money. I lost money. I was a panderer, a parasite. I lived good, wore good clothing, had lots of money, drove a nice car. But the places I used to go, I became unwelcome. You know, in New York, they have these little peepholes like we have in these hotel doors. And I'd knock on the door or ring the bell, and somebody would come to the door and look out and see it was me and turn around and go back. It began to be that I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I wasn't satisfied with the way my life was going. I had no idea that what was happening with me and the way I was feeling was in any way associated with alcohol. I took what is known as a geographical cure. I didn't feel it was a geographical cure at that time. I'd looked on it as a golden opportunity because some hustlers from New York came, came to New York, and I happened to hook up with them. And they were looking for a cut buddy, and one of them had a house out here in Columbus that wasn't making too much money and asked me if I'd run it for him, and I said I would. Came to Columbus, Ohio, and I met all the fine people in all the nice places. If you've ever been to Columbus, Ohio, and you know about Mount Vernon Avenue, you know about Long Street, you know about the Vineyard, those are the places that I went, making a lot of money, staying drunk 24 hours a day. Selling whiskey out of the house and drinking about as much as I was selling. I left there, stayed in Columbus for a little while, and I left there and I went to Buffalo, New York. And in Buffalo, New York, I hit a bottom that I did not associate with drinking. I tried to run my game on a whore. She had a pimp. They followed me home. I woke up the next morning. I was trying to steal her from him, and they stole everything I had. And the biggest thing that they stole was my pride. Because here I was a slick New Yorker and allowed somebody to give me a Mickey Finn and allowed somebody to rip me off. I woke up, my money was gone, my jewelry was gone, a lot of other things were gone, and my pride was gone. I attempted suicide at that point, closed up my house. My progression of my disease had accelerated. I was drinking at least a fifth of Dewar's White Label Scotch every day, plus what I was drinking bars when I was playing my horses and my numbers and the other things. But anyway, I had some scotch. I remember closing up the house, closing the windows, closing the doors, stuffing paper in, blowing out the lights on the pilot light on the gas stove, turning on the gas jets, and I sat down and I put my head in the oven. I was going to die young and make a beautiful corpse. While I had my head in that oven, I happened to think about my landlord and landlady, because I'm a bastard child. I never lived with my parents. And anyone that showed any kindness towards me, although I didn't react or show love back because I was incapable of loving, I had a tender feeling for them. And my alcoholic mind told me that when my partner came home from wherever he was on the road with that everlasting cigar that he kept stuck up in his face, that when he opened the door, the cigar was going to ignite the gas, and the gas was going to blow up the house, and it was going to hurt the people downstairs. I did not want that to happen, so that was the end of my suicide attempt. I think my head was about as big as that hat that Van was describing. That's all I got out of that. I came back to Columbus in 1952, and under the influence of alcohol, I committed a felony that put me in the higher penitentiary for the next 10 years of my life. I remember
when I was in the county jail. I've never told this in a lead, but I remember when I was in the county jail and was on the east side of South High Street, that the prosecutor came in and pointed his finger at me. And he told me that no New York gangster was going to come into his town and do what I did, and that he was going to put me in the electric chair. I looked at him and I shrugged. Shortly after that, in September of 1952, in shackles, I entered the higher penitentiary. And when I walked into the bullpen and heard that lonely clang, I looked up on the facade and it said, "All who enter here leave all hope behind." I shrugged it off. I was a survivor. I was a street person. Terrified on the inside, but was able to stuff those feelings. I went through the normal orientation that they give you in the institution, and when I came to the social worker to be classified and he asked me had I been drinking at the time of my offense, I gave him the classic drunken answer. Yeah, I had a couple of beers. So nothing showed on my record as being an alcoholic or having problems with alcohol. The first time I heard of Alcoholics Anonymous was in the higher penitentiary on Spring Street. But you see, I was like water, and I sought my own level. And if you didn't talk out the side of your neck and didn't walk with a swagger, and if you wasn't hustling and dealing and trying to get over, I didn't want to have anything to do with you. And those people that went to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought they were finks. I thought they were stoolies. I didn't want to be associated with them. I gravitated towards the people that did the things that I did. And I'm like Van. I have never been any place where the God of my understanding hasn't been. And my God has been with me from the day of my conception to right now standing here with you. And he watched over me and he gave me a job. Well, prior to that, I got a job in the laundry, in the prison laundry. And in the prison laundry, I hooked up with the people that dealt. And they showed me how to get some raisins and some potatoes and some sugar and some yeast. And to make what we call Raisin Jack. I never made any, but I drank a lot of it. They also showed me how to take some heat and put it under shoe polish and melt it down and drain it through white bread and drink the alcohol, and I did that. We had a paint shop, and they had some lacquer thinner, and that lacquer thinner was rather potent. I don't know what the proof was. I drank that. They had wood alcohol. I remember drinking wood alcohol with some friends. I remember one of them going blind, and nothing happened to me. I drank Listerine. I drank witch hazel. I drank aftershaving lotion. I would break open the nose inhalers and take out the narcotics and chew on it. I was prescribed medication and I used it to get high. Anything to get me away from where I was inside of my head, I did it. After being in the laundry for a little period of time, I went before the Honor Classification Committee and they gave me a job working in the Office of Psychological Services. And I had the run of the institution. I was what you call a red cap. I was out on the yard first thing in the morning, and I was one of the last ones to be locked up at night. We had a crooked psychologist working in the clinic, and he would bring in pills, uppers and downers, almost by the pillowcase full. And I was dealing pills for him and for another inmate all over the institution. And it was only by the grace of God that I ever got busted. After a period of time, I was again put before the Honor Placement Committee, and they gave me a job in that little red house right on the inside of the big wall on the east side of the penitentiary facing Spring Street. And that was to be my home for the next several years. I don't remember exactly when I went out there, but I know I was out there for about 5 or 6 years. And my job was to take care of the governor's mansion, the laundry of the governor's mansion. And at that point, they had inmates working at the mansion. The governor had an inmate chauffeur. He had inmate butlers, and the inmates did all the work in the house. My job was to do the flatware and to do their uniforms, which I did. Not only did I take care of the governor's mansion, but we had some rather influential gangsters and affluent inmates in the Honor Dormitory, and I did their laundry for them also. also. I told you that I was a gambler. I transformed my cell into a gambling casino. Guard tower was right here. My window was right here. And nobody had done this before me. But I sent downtown and I got some drapes and I put them on my windows. I put the other pair on my door. I hired me two lookouts and I had them at both ends of the hall. And every night in my cell, I had a skin game, a poker game, or a crap game going, sometimes having all three of them going. I was making money hand over fist. A lot of people think that the administration runs the institution. They do not. It's the inmates that run it. And there was an inmate that came out who had been the secretary for the warden, and that young dude carried a lot of power, but he couldn't gamble. And I carried him. And he kept the man off my back. We had a group of men that were working down in the central warehouse, which was located on Cleveland Avenue. And I would give them some money, and they would bring me in two bottles of Vat 69 every night of the week, except Saturday and Sunday. I had a guard that was on the gate on my payroll, and I had guards that were inside the institution on my payroll. When I got a great deal of money, I would give it to the governor's chauffeur. He would take it to the bank and bring me back a nice, crisp $100 bill. And I lived the life of Riley, progressing in my disease. When I was behind the walls, I saw all of the injustices that were going on, because I don't know if anybody in here has been in the institution, but they give you a list of rules that I don't think Jesus Christ himself could keep without breaking during the course of the day. And I was resentful at the rules that we had, and I was resentful at the treatments that some of the inmates got. I was resentful towards the sadistic attitude of some of the guards, the lack of feeling, the lack of compassion. And I had told the fellas when I went out front, I said, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to go downtown to the governor, and I'm going to go to the parole board, and I'm going to tell them what's going on here, and we'll see if we can't get some of these situations righted. When I got out front, I still maintained that attitude, but I was too busy qualifying to come to see you. Eventually, I made a parole, and when I came out of the institution, there wasn't any restrictions on me other than the normal restrictions that I shouldn't drink, because I had nothing on my record to indicate that I was an alcoholic. And in fact, I didn't know that myself. Needless to say, there were several times that I got drunk, was arrested. For some reason, my parole officer did not put me in jail. Among my addictions is the one that we have a program for, sex. I was a very lustful individual. In fact, when I found out the little boys were constructed differently from little girls, I had a Jones that I still got. But anyway, I was able to get a job with a millionaire in Upper Arlington, and I was to be a chauffeur and his houseboy and a lot of other things. And working up there was one of those kitchen mechanics that Van was talking about in his lead, because you see, back in New York, I used to play those kitchen mechanics too. Thursday was their payday. And we would wait for them on Thursday. And the very same thing that he did, with the exception of buying the bra and the panties, I ain't never bought them nothing. Bought them a drink. Took their money. And see, I brought all of that back here to Columbus, Ohio with me. But anyway, there was this woman that worked up in Upper Arlington. And she had a New York accent. I happened to meet her. I was riding a bus and she was riding a bus. And my eyeballs focused in on her rear end, which looked like the rear end of a Mark V. And I said to myself, I got to have that. And I proceeded to make overtures. But what I did not know was that woman was what we call a holy roller. She was an evangelist in an apostolic church. And she was after getting me baptized in the water, and I was going to try to baptize her under my sheets. Nevertheless, she won out. And I got baptized. I received the Holy Spirit because it was a charismatic church, and a miracle happened. I don't know what the progression of my disease was. I can only tell you what I was doing that Saturday before I went to church that Sunday. I was drinking by that time. My progression had decreased. I was drinking about a pint of whiskey a day. Because from the time I was 14, with very few instances, there wasn't a day that went by in my life that I did not have some type of mood-altering, mind-removing chemical in my system. I didn't think about the morning drink because I went to a lot of after-hour spots. The bars in New York closed at 4 o'clock. The after-hour spots are open. I would go to the after-hour spot, come out at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, take a drink before I went home, sleep for 2 or 3 hours, get up, put my numbers in, place me some horse race bets, check my traps with my horse to see what they're doing, and party all day long. So drinking was a way of life with me. I didn't think anything about the morning drink. But anyway, when I met this woman, my tolerance had taken me down to about a pint a day. There might have been some more. I was smoking quite heavily. I'm doing it again. I got to take a look at that. But I was smoking about 2.5 packs of cigarettes a day. And my language was the language of the street. And literally every other word I spoke was a hyphenated vulgarity. I just did not know how to speak properly. The miracle of salvation occurred to me. That Sunday morning when I went to go to church, I was smoking Philip Morris, I'll never forget it. I picked up the pack, I put a cigarette in my mouth and got ready to put the pack in my pocket. And something said, which I now know is the God of my understanding, put those down, you won't need them. I laid them on the dresser. I went to church. I got baptized. I had my religious experience. And it was a spiritual experience. And I lost the taste for alcohol. I lost the desire to smoke. My vocabulary cleaned up. And I became as hungry as I am hungry now for the words of wisdom that I find in these rooms. I became hungry for the Word of God. I went to Bible classes. I studied. I carried my Bible wherever I went. And being an overachieving alcoholic, because we are overachievers, and we are gifted, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we're gifted by the God of our understanding. And I became a licensed minister. I married that woman because I didn't have a sponsor to tell me don't make any major decisions for a year. I didn't have a sponsor to tell me easy does it. And I didn't have a sponsor in the church to tell me live and let live. But the bottom line was that I became an ordained minister. I got a job at the United States government where I work today. And I became an ordained minister. I was ordained in Zanesville, Ohio. I got called to Bel Air, Ohio to pastor a church temporarily. Supposed to be there for a week. Stayed there for 6 months. When I came back, there was a church in Akron, Ohio that had just split and they were without a pastor. And I preached for them on a Sunday morning. And they asked me if I would come and pastor them, and I said that I would. I resigned my job with the government. I came to Akron, Ohio to take the pastorate. The church split because of factions and because of some things with my wife. And the bishop and the presiding elders in that area of the diocese suggested that those members of the congregation who wanted to follow me could go with me, and they gave me permission to establish a church. I established a church in Akron, Ohio. It's a flourishing church today. I haven't visited it for a while, but I will. Like I told you, when I came to pastor that church in Akron, the congregation had split. It was a great, big, fine church. But it had split, and my wife, who I had married, was grandiose like me, and I'm not here to take her inventory. But she was accustomed to a good lifestyle. And I knew that the earnings, if you could call it that, or the monies that I would receive from ministering to this congregation would not be sufficient to support my wife and myself in the style that we were accustomed. So I applied for a job with the state of Ohio. And it just so happened that they were looking for someone who had been in prison who could relate with ex-convicts coming home. And they hired me as a parole officer. And I became very good. My average caseload was supposed to be 35 people. I wound up with an average caseload of 100, 120. Very successful parole officer. Walking with God to the best of my ability, Holy Ghost, Spirit-filled, trying to live a life of righteousness, godliness, and holiness in this present world. I didn't drink. I didn't curse. I didn't smoke. I didn't run around on my wife. I didn't commit adultery. And you notice, I is in everything that I said. Because even though I was a Spirit-filled minister and was known as a walking Bible, I was an untreated alcoholic. And all of the isms that I had not addressed in me were still prevalent. I could tell you how to change your life. I have preached the gospel and seen alcoholics rescued and come into my church and live a life of sobriety and overcoming. But I was not able to do that to myself. This woman that I married, I found out had some very serious personality differences, if I might say. And I became rather disillusioned and disappointed. I became lonely in my own home. I was dealing with frustration on a daily basis. And though I would talk with the ministering brethren, the relief just would not come. One day I had a young man come home from Mansfield, Ohio. He was supposed to come home because as a parole officer, what you're supposed to do is go visit the home to see if it's a suitable place, and then you bring the young man or the young woman out of the institution. And I made this home visitation, I made this home placement. And this young man's mother was living in the same spiritual, mental condition that I was. Her marriage was in shambles. Her husband had personality differences. She was lonely and upset. And I was lonely and upset. She was attractive. And one of my character defects began to surface. And like they say in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that a slip doesn't happen overnight. Neither in the religious world does a slip or backsliding happen overnight. Because to keep myself in spiritual tone, I fasted, I prayed, I read, I meditated. Basically in a parallel, the same things that you tell me to do here. I used to get on my knees every morning and pray. I would get on my knees every night and pray. And all during the course of the day, I would pray. But I found out with a caseload of 120, with a wife that was a bickering shrew, with the loneliness and the frustration that I felt, the physical weariness, I knew that God would understand if I did not get on my knees at night. So that was the first thing that went. I knew that He would understand if I overslept in the morning and couldn't get on my knees during the day. I knew that He would understand if I just didn't have time because of all of these reports to read the scriptures. I knew He would understand because of the tiredness of my body if I stopped fasting. And what I'm basically saying, the things that I was doing to maintain what I had, I let slide by the wayside. In addition, the impression of this beautiful woman was impregnated in my mind, and the chairman of the board, Dick, you know, everybody hears about the committee. Well, my chairman's name is Dick. He was smoking a joint. And I'm a slip hip boy from New York, and she offered me a hit. And because I was not spiritually in the place where I should be, I accepted. And like Frank said, you take another drug, and it will lead you back to the drug of your choice. And after 16 or 17 years, without a drink, without a mood-altering chemical, I smoked a joint, my throat got dry, she had some Tanqueray gin, and I was off and running. The bottom line was, I resigned my pulpit. I was forced to resign my job with the Adult Parole Authority. I became practically unemployable. The police officers of Akron, Ohio were some of my biggest enablers. They wouldn't arrest me. And I sunk down to the depths of degradation and despair. I had a lot of blackouts. I believe that everything that Van said, he did, I believe I did. I became spiritually, morally, physically, emotionally, and financially bankrupt. I played a trump card. I called my former employer, the government, because I had left an excellent record with them, and told them that I wanted to come back. And there was a hiring freeze on, but God again stepped in. He opened the door. They opened the door for hiring for one day, and I slid in. And when I went back, they said that they were glad to see me, glad to have me, because they needed people like me. And after I was on that job for 2 or 3 weeks, they wished they had never seen me. I was drinking daily. I'll just give you an idea of what I was doing. On a daily basis, we were working 7 to 14 hours a day. My day would start in the morning. I would wake up, I'd reach down to the side of the bed, and I'd have about that much Wild Irish Rose left in the glass, and I would drink it. I'd reach over in the ashtray, and I'd get me a doobie, and I'd fire it up. I'd go to the bathroom, and I'd wash my mouth out, and I might drink the mouthwash, because it has some alcohol in it, there's a waste in it. I'd fix me a cup of coffee. I'd go to the stop-and-go store. I could walk to work. I'd pick me up a pint or a shorty of Wild Irish Rose. I would drink it. I would go to work. I would come out at 9 o'clock on break time and fire me up a joint, make a beeline to the store, get me a shorty and drink it and go back to work. At 11:30, I'd come out with a group of people that drank and smoked like I did, and we drank and smoked our lunch. At 2 o'clock break, I'd go to the car because I always had some beer in the car. I can't do that anymore. Not only because I'm not in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's just a federal offense anymore now to bring containers on a government installation. But anyway, I'd go to my car and I'd drink some beer and I'd go back to work. And around about that time, I would start eating speed because I was dealing speed with the government. And I would take as much speed as I dealt. I'd get off from work around about 8 o'clock at night, and there's a bar right around the corner. I would go in there. I might or might not get me something to eat. I picked up 4 OMVIs, which I'm not going to talk about. I went to 2 treatment centers, which I'm not going to talk about. And just went to hell. 4 years ago, because of these shenanigans, the government was ready to fire me. I had my last drink on August 31st, 1985. And I was told by the beautiful lady that introduced me to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I came in that morning, and I pointed my finger straight at her. I walked straight to her, pointed my finger at her, said, "I don't want to hear nothing about that AA shit," and proceeded to tear my rear end. I was escorted off of the base by the security, and I went home in utter despair. When I woke up that Saturday morning with that humongous hangover and just the feelings of guilt and paranoia and despair and frustration, I didn't know what to do. And then a light went on in my head because I remembered back to the time that I had resigned from the government before. And 90 days to the day that you resign, they give you your retirement money. And I had built up a little bit of retirement money. And I said I was going to hustle and survive until the retirement money came in. When the retirement money came in, the first thing I was going to do was buy 2 Texas fifths of vodka. I'm going to set it aside. And when my money ran out, where I could no longer pay my rent, I was going to drink myself to death. That Sunday morning, I called my girlfriend that Saturday night, and I called my daughter. I ran everybody crazy. They didn't know where I was because I wouldn't tell them where I was. And I told them I was going to kill myself. I wouldn't let anybody in. I wouldn't answer the telephone. They couldn't find me. I didn't have a car by that time. My car had been totaled. I'd been to the hospital. I'd been to jail several times. And I was just a mess. That Sunday morning, I woke up, and a voice said, "Go to church." And I'm not going to go into all of the details, but I had an argument with God that morning. He told me to go to church. I told him I wasn't going to go. He said, "Go." I said, "I'm not going to go." I said, "Well, what church should I go to?" He told me. And you see, I had been separated from my wife since 1981, and this is in 1985. No, I've been separate, yes, 1981. I said, "Well, she goes to that church." He said, "I said, go." Well, I came out of my house, and there was a neighbor that I used to drink vodka with and smoke reefer with. She lived next door to me. And I asked her to take me to church. She said she couldn't because her brother was coming in. There was a Jewish lady that lived two doors down that heard me talking. She said, "Where do you want to go?" And I told her. She said, "Get in the car, I'll take you." And she asked me, "Where is it?" And I told her. And she took me to church. And needless to say, the people in the church were glad to see me. They wondered what had happened to me. And I don't know what the minister spoke about, but I knew I had to do something. Because when I was in the treatment center the first time, they had taken me in an introductory way through the steps. And I had gone through step 4, which was nothing more than a biography. It wasn't done according to the way that the big book suggests. But anyway, I had a flash of brilliance between the time I left home and the time I went to church. And I said, "I know what I'll do. I'll go to confession, because in order to renew myself in my ministry, I had to go to confession." And then, of course, I would sit underneath the pastor. And in due time, they would give me a church, and I would be able to live off of the proceeds of the church. I was going to prostitute the gift that God had given me. And I went to the minister, and I told him that I wanted to see him. I wanted to talk with him. He gave me a date, and I went to work the next day. By this time, I was in touch with who is now my sponsor and also a counselor. We had an EAP counselor. And I told the counselor, I said, "I have an appointment with this minister for Wednesday evening. Would it be okay if I did my fifth step?" And he said, "Certainly." And I went to see the minister that evening, and I told him that I said, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have in our fellowship 12 steps. And one step says, admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs." I said, "And in the course of my confession, I would like to do a fifth step." He said he understood. And I began to talk. And I emptied. When I finished, he said, "Are you through, Brother Scott?" And I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "We're going to pray." And I've known this man for quite a while, and I have never heard him use this word. But in his prayer, he said, "God, give him sobriety." And it rang like a bell in my soul. And after he had finished praying, he told me something else. He said, "Now, Brother Scott," he says, "God has forgiven you." He says, "And you are not bigger than God. You've got to forgive yourself." And I walked out of his office like the weight of the world had been lifted up off of me. I had a feeling that was almost akin to the feeling the day that I received the Holy Spirit. And I was free. And words that you had told me came back. First words that came back was, "Stick with the winners." I'd been told that. But see, I was a grown man. You don't tell me what to do. I was also told that those who stay sober in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous are people who are busy. So I began to get busy and empty ashtrays and come to the meetings early and try to set them up. And if I didn't get there early, I would stay late and I'd try to turn them down. I didn't get a sponsor. I'm another one that has a woman sponsor. For some reason, I couldn't reach out to get the men I wanted. I remember I wanted Leon for a sponsor. I wanted Clarence R. for a sponsor. I wanted Lowell B. for a sponsor. And for some reason, I never found those men. They were hidden from me. But where I worked, there was a lady by the name of Sandy D. I didn't ask Sandy to be my sponsor. And she didn't volunteer to be my sponsor. But she would tell me, she would call me up and say, "I'll be there in 5 minutes to take you to a meeting." And it seemed like she was leading all over the place. And the first Saturday in my sobriety, she picked me up on the way to the library with her daughter. And she took me down to our central office. And she said, "There's a men's meeting in there. So you go into that men's meeting and you get your coffee and you sit down and you shake some hands and get some telephone numbers. And you take the cotton out of your ears and you stick it in your mouth and don't you say nothing until I tell you." And for a year or better, that was part of my program. You men literally snatched me back from the jaws of death. I began to hear the things that I needed to hear. And I still had that denial in me. And one day I picked up the big book and was reading in the chapter that did not apply to me. And that was the chapter to the agnostic. I was not an agnostic. I was a Holy Ghost-filled, apostolic, Jesus-only minister. I knew who God was. You didn't know who he was, but I knew who he was. And the words jumped off the page. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. And I began to realize that I could not utilize the power that God had given me. And the only way that I could get that power was by admitting that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. I got involved in service. There was a committee that was active in Area 53 that the name struck me. It was Cooperation with the Professional Community. And after all, I had been a professional. I'm an ordained minister. I've been a parole officer, blah, 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 blah. So I went to visit the committee for Cooperation with the Professional Community, and I found some beautiful, loving alcoholics, and I began to get involved. At 6 months, Central Office brought a young man to me and asked me if I would work with him. And I went to two or three people in the fellowship and said, no, you don't know nothing. You don't know nothing. And I asked my sponsor and I asked someone else, and they said, yes, work with that young man. I'm happy to say he is a sober young man today. Just celebrated his third year of sobriety. And by working with him, I ensured my sobriety. By being active in service and being active in the fellowship, around about 8 months, I was asked to leave. Someone heard that I had been in the institution, because I mentioned it in my lead, and some of the fellows that visited the institutions came to me and asked me if I would go. And it dawned on me that the promise I had made to those inmates that I was going to come back and try to do something about the conditions that existed there, not knowing the mysterious workings of the God of my understanding, I was able to go back to the institutions. Sometimes to lead, sometimes just to be in fellowship. And my prayers go out to those men there, because you see, I know the conditions that exist in institutions. AA is there. And those young men that are not playing games, that attend the AA meetings, they need all of our prayers, because they have a tremendous amount of courage. They're looked down upon. They're mistrusted. They're misunderstood. And there are individuals in those institutions that try to get them drunk. There is just as much alcohol and drugs in the institutions as there is out here in the street. And they look forward to us coming. They need the meetings. They need examples of men and women who have found the serenity and sobriety of this fellowship. I try to go to institutions as often as I can. And I used to be able to boast until a few years ago that I had been to every major institution in the state of Ohio. But you see, they've built a couple more that I have not yet been to. But being involved in CPC, I'm involved in institutions, but in my own personal program, I'm involved in the institutions. And without being grandiose, and if I am, shoot me down, I feel that the best leads that I have ever given has been talking to men and women who were shackled like I was. We're talking about AA in prison. And I told you that when I walked into the Ohio Penitentiary, I looked above that facade and I said, all who enter here leave all hope behind. But I remember when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for the very first time, it said, all hope is found here. And I have found the hope here. Not only have I found the hope here, but through the practicing of the principles of the steps and trying to practice the principles in all of my affairs, looking back, I realized that I placed myself under arrest when I took that first drink. I sentenced myself to a life sentence of prison, insanity, or death. But the God of my understanding, through those of you who care and share, brought about a conditional release. A conditional release. I have been paroled and pardoned conditionally. That I read the big book, that I pray, that I go to meetings, that I care and share with you. that I do the things that are suggested. And if I do those things, I'll be able to trudge that happy road of destiny. I realize that iron walls, or what is it, concrete walls, stone walls, do not a prison make, or iron bars a cell. It is the character defects, the inabilities, the frustrations, the despairs, the hatreds, the resentments, the animosity, the pride, the grandiosity, the intellectualism, the addiction and the compulsion that had me locked up within myself. I wanted to do good. I didn't know how to. I wanted to be good. I didn't know how to. I didn't want the pain. I didn't know how to rid myself of it. My way, as so many of us say, got me here. So when I talk about AA in prison, I'm talking about AA in this prison. The shackles have been loosed. The God of my understanding has said, loose him and let him go free. And I try, by the grace of God, through the love that you have given me, because I was incapable of loving. You loved me until I could love myself. I was incapable of forgiving, but you accepted me until I could get forgiveness. I was incapable of doing anything that I wanted to do, but you showed me the way. You told me to walk with you and follow your example. The peace of mind that I have looked for in the I never shot up by the grace of God yet. I got to put the yet on there. But the peace of mind I was looking for in the reefer, in the pills, in the bottle, in the sex, and in every compulsive act, I have found in the surrendering, turning my will and my life over to the care of the God of my understanding. Now, I have never seen God nor touched him. He has seen me, and he has touched me. But I know through my theology, and I know through my understanding as he deals with me, that you're the eyes of God, you're the hands of God, you're the feet of God, you're the heart of God, you're the love of God, you're the mouth of God. And if I stay with you, I will stay with my God. I'm no longer locked up in my prison, but I'm mindful of those who are locked up in prisons in these rooms and out of these rooms, and then, of course, those that are incarcerated behind steel bars. The power of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous will set anyone free. And there are men that are behind the walls right now serving sentences of life, double life, or intermediate sentences, and some even sitting on death row who are free because of the principles of this God-given fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what Frank had to say. I love what Vance had to say. I heard what Barry said. I think I like what Barry said this morning. About every 10 days, he goes to an institution. If you're having problem with your serenity, if you're having problems with your acceptance, if you're having problems with your peace of mind or your gratitude, go to an institution. It is no more than to take a pamphlet and tell the guys, I understand. Tell the girls, yeah, I know. And reach out the hand. And that's part of my program. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out the hand for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. And for that, I am responsible. And in giving of what you have given me, I receive so much. I'm so grateful to be here. I'm overwhelmed. You can't see what's going on the inside. But like I used to say in church, the joy bells are ringing. It is well with my soul. And I can enter into the gates of my God, and I can say, as Dr. Martin Luther King said, I am free at last. I am free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. I love you, and God bless you.
We are from the National Men's, the National Men's Conference, and the position is a token of our appreciation. Thank you again for sharing the story. God bless you.
Thank you.
That was fantastic. I guess we can all stand and say the Lord's Prayer. Huh?
You better get down there and get that right.
You can't start without me.